I mean, some, at least temptation, maybe it should seem unclear to you, but in that unclarity, some thought that, well, maybe it's the whole physical system somehow, right? There's this whole complicated physical system, and inside the system there are all these patterns. The patterns come through the overall whole. There's one single physical substance, and then there's all these individual ways it gets modified. Okay, that'd be one way to go. What would the alternatives be? Well, any given region of matter is a primary being, maybe. Maybe it has to be like point-like. Maybe it has to be infinitesimally small. If you're on the other view, is it just the corpuscles? Are they going to be the substances, or something else? That's a question that both Spinoza and Leibniz are very much interested in, and it gets reopened in a new way when the science changes. Okay. That's just to give you a flavor. Give you a little bit more than a flavor, because it really does tie into the first question. But the thing I want you to take away most immediately is the new science disrupts the Aristotelian picture. And it doesn't just disrupt at the level of natural philosophy, at the level of science. It's going to raise a whole lot of other questions at the same time. And that's partly because the Aristotelian view is so systematic. You're going to think about change very differently. You're going to think about causation very differently. You're going to think about what a physical thing is very differently. It's not going to seem like a composite of form and matter. You're going to think about substance very differently as the physics changes. Okay, I'm going to start to move back. All this is going to give you a different picture of early modern philosophy, and I want to start to move back toward that. There are two, it seems to me, two general reactions to the situation. Okay, and they're quite interesting. There's the reaction that the rationalists have, and there's Locke's reaction, then gets maybe developed in Berkeley and Hume. The rationalist, it seems to me, take on the Aristotelian project. Okay, they want to provide a systematic theory of the universe, a systematic theory of everything, even if they have to revise it somewhat radically at places. They're still interested very much in this idea of substance. They're still interested in this Aristotelian question, okay? Where are the substances now that we've moved to this new world? They're interested in God's relationship to the universe and working out a theory of that. Something I haven't talked much about, but I will be talking about, they're interested in the essences of things. What it is to be matter, what it is to be mind. And they think that they're ready to give you a theory that tells you what it is to be a physical thing, what it is to be a mind. They even think human beings know what it is to be God, or what makes God tick. That was something that Aquinas thought you could not possibly know in this life. The Aristotelians think you can know God's essence. Okay, you can know the essence of matter. You can know the essence. I'm sorry. The rationalists think you can know God's essence. You can know the essence of matter. You can know the essence of body. You can understand how all that stuff fits together. Okay, so they're going to try to give you the same comprehensive picture of the universe. I mean, not the same picture, but they're going to give you a picture, comprehensive picture of the universe, the way the Aristotelians try to give you a comprehensive picture of the universe. It's quite optimistic and bold what they want to do. Okay, they want to basically answer all the big questions. That's part of what I think it is to be a rationalist. It is to think that human reason is up to that task, that we can come up with a theory of everything that will, maybe not in all the details, but will sketch an outline answers to all the major metaphysical questions. Okay. There's another reaction. Okay, so that's how I think of the rationalists, and that's how we will be kind of looking at them in the first half of the course. First half of the course takes 6.5 weeks because there's a week of introduction, and I find a rationalist more interesting than the empiricist, so I cheat a little bit. So in that sense, the first half, we'll see how they give us a theory of everything, but in the context of the new science, you know, giving up the Aristotelian natural philosophy. They have to go into some pretty interesting, surprising directions to be able to do that, we'll see. The other reaction begins especially with Locke. And Locke's somebody I do have a lot of respect for. He's kind of the anti-rationalist here. And instead of taking away from the new science, so the new science kind of emboldens Descartes and Spinoza and Leibniz to think, yes, we're finally getting closer and closer to the truth, and we have to make some adjustments, but now we really kind of understand how it all works, how it all hangs together. Locke's kind of impressed by how wrong we were for 2,000 years, and thinks that we're really groping in the dark. The corpuscular hypothesis is just a hypothesis. It seems a lot better than the old view. It seems to be a glimmer of how we might go in a better direction. But we don't really understand the corpuscular hypothesis itself very well. For example, we got these corpuscles, right? They're supposed to be infinitely hard. What is it that holds the corpuscle together? We don't really know. Maybe there's some new theory, something underneath that. When two corpuscles come together, why do they go apart? Why don't they just stick together? We don't really know. Locke holds that if you think about it, really what we've learned is just, in a way, how ignorant we are. We made progress. I mean, he doesn't want to go back, but as we make this progress, it's a very tentative, groping kind of progress. It's not the sort of progress that makes you think you're almost at the bottom of things. All we really know about the corpuscles are a few relatively superficial properties. You know, they take up space, they have shape, they have bulk. We don't know much more about minds or spirits, as Locke calls them. We know that they think, they have wills. We don't know how spirits do anything. We don't know how their wills have effects in the world. To sort of move a little bit toward Katja's question, instead of thinking about bodies in general, if we think about a particular kind of body like gold, we have really no idea what the corpuscular structure is that gives gold the properties that it has, as opposed to, you know, to some other properties. We're really very much in the dark. That's the kind of a philosophical modesty that Locke takes as the moral from the new science. One of the things you want to keep in mind, this has to do with the primitiveness and the naiveness of these views. This is before, not long before, but before chemistry. Okay, so there's not like an atomic theory, there's not water's H2O, there's just corpuscles, okay? And Locke is thinking that, you know, any two pieces of gold are going to be just hopelessly complex corpuscular structures. They have some kinds of similarity, otherwise they wouldn't look alike and behave alike in lots of ways. And he thinks there are also going to be deep dissimilarities. And Locke takes that modesty that I was talking about. Just the message he takes from this is that we're really very much in the dark. And it affects also how he thinks about philosophy. Okay, so he thinks that we just haven't been given the requisite ideas to answer any of the big metaphysical questions. This question, what are the primary beings? What is the substance? He thinks the only idea of we do have some idea of substance or what a substance is supposed to be, but it's a very vague, obscure, relative idea. It's not the kind of doesn't have the kind of crispness that it would need for us to do the metaphysical project that Spinoza and Leibniz are going to do. Another question that we're kind of interested in, or Locke's kind of interested in, can matter think? Or in order for there to be thinking, do you always need an immaterial thing, an immaterial substance perhaps, around to do the thinking? Can bare matter, maybe suitably arranged, do the thinking, or do you always need something else to have thinking going on? Locke thinks we just haven't been given the ideas that we would need to be able to figure out the answer to that question. So Spinoza and Leibniz are kind of bold and optimistic and think it's possible to do a whole bunch of metaphysics, Locke is much more either sober or pessimistic, depending on your point of view, thinking, gee, we're not all that far along in physics, and our prospects to make great metaphysical discoveries are very dim. Okay, we're not going to study Locke, but from time to time I'll be bringing his views in. Berkeley and Hume, I think they don't quite fit into the story I'm telling as naturally as everybody else. Take pieces. Berkeley takes a piece of what Locke does. We'll see this, and takes it much further. So Locke. Part of what Locke is doing is saying, before we go try to do a bunch of metaphysics, before we start to do a lot of philosophy, let's just sit back and look at what kinds of resources we have for knowing, what are the kinds of questions we can hope to make progress with, what are the kinds of questions that we just don't have a lot to do. So we start, so it's called Essay Concerning Human Understanding. We think first about the human understanding, and we try to think about what seem to be its obvious limitations, what seem to be the places where it might hope to do something. Berkeley, in a certain way, you could say, takes that further. He wants us to, again, like Locke, begin with thinking about human cognition. So one of the works that we're going not to read, not going to be reading, is called The Principles of Human Knowledge. And he wants to think there about abstract ideas, okay? Part of human cognition. Some of you may have looked at this in Philosophy 21. In the work that we're going to be reading, the Three Dialogues, Berkeley wants us to think about how perception works, how sensation or perception works. Okay? And Berkeley holds that if we really hone in and think hard about human cognition, we're going to get to some surprising results. The main result will be that the only thing we could possibly sense or perceive is one of these mental ideas, one of these internal ideas that I had on the board at the beginning. Sorry, we're already past the time. I will say 5 minutes on Locke and Berkeley on Wednesday, and start on some Aristotelian ontology in more detail, just more background on Wednesday.